The Tom Woods Show, episode 2180.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you enjoy the Tom Woods Show, it's time to go to the next level. And next level, Tom Woods, is libertyclassroom.com. This is where my friends and I teach all the stuff you did not get in your conventional education, history, economics, and more, the way it ought to be taught, with all the content they left out or distorted. Check it out at libertyclassroom.com.
Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here, joined once again by Jason Jewell, chairman of the Department of Humanities at Faulkner University. We're going to continue our discussion of communism, and we're going to today briefly visit both China and Eastern Europe and hit some of the, I can't call them highlights, but I guess lowlights from those places. Jason, you'll recall, just released a brand new course on the crimes of communism for libertyclassroom.com, the site that I've had for 10 years that teaches the real stuff that for one reason or another, we're not being taught in the official institutions. So check that out. I'm celebrating the release of Jason's course with a bit of a flash sale. So hurry up on over there before that goes away. So libertyclassroom.com is the website. Jason, welcome back.
It's great to be back with you, Tom.
All right, more communism, just what the world needs. But of course, we need the truth about it. And you're not going to get that in most settings. You certainly won't get it in the entertainment world, that's for sure. And yet, there is so much fodder for important dramas and documentaries, and yet so little is done with it. Anyway, we finished up saying a little something about Stalin last time. There's so many different areas covered in your course here. It's hard to know what to choose, but I do want to talk about particularly significant episodes in world history, and that would include communism in China. Because there, the numbers that you hear about deaths seem so mind-boggling that you think they can't possibly be real. And then you do have apologists who say that, well, you know, it's the old bad weather excuse, right? You know, things like that. You know, that there's unusually bad weather in these communist countries, and that's why so many people starved or whatever it is. But let's pause and say something about China. You would think this would be an area where everybody would agree. There couldn't possibly be anybody who would say, actually, Mao was a great humanitarian, you know, and yet somehow we have that in academia. So can you give us a Reader's Digest version of the atrocities?
Yeah, it's interesting that even the Chinese Communist Party has moderated its adulation of Mao in recent years. And if you go to China today and take a tour, and you'll get the Communist Party line, and they will acknowledge that Mao wasn't all good. They still hail him as a great hero, but there is increasingly some acknowledgement of the horrors brought about by the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution. And these are the two major episodes in Chinese communist history where we have deaths in the tens of millions. Of course, the communists were murdering people on a large scale even before that, before the late 1950s, going back to their early days in the 1920s in certain cities like Shanghai, when they would momentarily take control of a region or a city. They would try to liquidate landowners and stir up artificial class hatreds and all that sort of thing. So I talk about that at some length in the lecture on China. But after they gained control of the country at the conclusion of a civil war, after World War II, they declare the People's Republic of China. They're in the late 1940s. And from that point on, they are very aggressively moving towards collectivization. Mao was a great admirer of Joseph Stalin. And when Nikita Khrushchev embarks on the de-Stalinization campaign in the mid-1950s, Mao considers Khrushchev to be a traitor to true socialism. So he's pursuing a more or less Stalinist line throughout the 50s, 60s, and 70s. But the two big episodes, as I said, are the Great Leap Forward in the late 1950s and the Cultural Revolution starting in 1966. So the more devastating of these was the Great Leap Forward. This is where Mao had started implementing some collectivization of agriculture. And after the first year, he thought the signs were pretty encouraging. There had been a very good harvest that first season. And so he wanted to push forward and not only continue with the collectivization, but also he had this kind of harebrained scheme of bringing industry to the countryside. And they were setting up what came to be called backyard furnaces and the peasants' farms and things like that. So the idea was that the peasants were both going to be moving into these agricultural communes that would be self-sufficient, but then they would also be doing industrial work out there in the countryside on this small scale. Well, the industrial work they did all was ridiculous. None of the products of these backyard furnaces were any good, so that was a big waste of time. There was also a lot of misallocation of capital and a forcing of the peasants to upset the, you know, kind of what they had over centuries determined was the proper ecological balance in their regions, on their farms. But they made these peasants do this very intensive cultivation of cereal crops to the exclusion of almost everything else. And they also imported the crackpot ideas of the Soviet scientist Lysenko, who tried to bring in Marxist class ideology into the natural sciences. And so they told the peasants that they had to sow seed at a much denser rate than they would normally do, because supposedly, according to Lysenko, the seeds would benefit from being in close proximity to their comrades, the other seeds. It was all completely crazy stuff. So when they start doing this on a large scale, the crops fail. You've got massive shortages in the countryside, but these communes are all supposed to be self-sufficient. So they're even prohibited from trading with one another. You're supposed to have all of this great stuff being produced in your commune and a surplus that then can be taken to the cities. So the Communist Party officials go to get all this alleged surplus, and of course there's none there. So they take the food that the peasants need for themselves to survive and then continue to threaten them to say, well, we know you've got more grain hidden in your basements or wherever. And so they're killing the peasants and threatening them and trying to get this non-existent, you know, treasure troves of grain from them. So this goes on for a couple of years. And one of the craziest things about it is that for the first year or so, everyone conspired to lead Mao to think that it was going great. They were also scared of confronting him with the truth of what was happening in the countryside, that in fact, China was even exporting grain during the early stages of the Great Leap Forward, grain that the peasants needed to survive and the peasants were starving. So we've got, again, rough estimates, somewhere between 20 and 45 million people dying in the space of a couple of years here in the late 1950s as a result of this Great Leap Forward, which was actually a great leap backward for Chinese civilization. The other big incident in Chinese communist history was the Cultural Revolution, which goes from 1966 up until the death of Mao in 1976. And this was a phase in which Mao was trying to reclaim direct control of the Communist Party. After the Great Leap Forward and the disaster that everybody had ultimately been forced to acknowledge, Mao was forced to give up some control of the party to other officials. And this was the situation that persisted for several years. But then in 1966, Mao thought that he was in danger of becoming a mere figurehead, and he wanted to make sure that he stayed in control. And so he mobilized. He had some allies in the top ranks of the Chinese Communist Party, in particular, the guy who was in charge of the People's Liberation Army. And one of the things that had been implemented in the early 1960s was obligatory military training for all teenagers. So what they decide to do then is indoctrinate these teenagers who are doing this military training into this cult of personality for Mao. And in 1966, Mao decides to kind of unleash these teenagers and university students onto the other elements of the Communist Party that he thinks might not be loyal to him. So we've got, and some of the folks listening have probably seen images of this, these teenagers in the military uniforms carrying these little red books that were the sayings of Chairman Mao, and going around and challenging anyone who had ever voiced any kind of criticism of Mao or any sort of doubts about the Communist Party line or anything like that. So a lot of intellectuals were targeted, a lot of people who were not considered to be loyal to Mao personally were targeted. And so throughout China, we've got these what were called Red Guards kind of unleashed on the population. And Mao actually gave the order that all schools and universities were going to be shut down for 6 months. And while the schools were shut down, these idle teenagers who didn't have anything to do formed gangs and mobs and went out and essentially were instituting a reign of terror in most of the Chinese cities. The police in these cities were told to back the Red Guards, to support them in what they were doing. And so there's a lot of mob violence during those years. It even gets to the point where some historians have described what's going on in some stages of the Cultural Revolution as a civil war. But in the end, we've got probably an estimate of 8 to 10 million people who were killed as a result over this 10-year period.
It's hard to know what to say about this, right? I mean, you're just left speechless at it. And that there are people who, even to this day, would make excuses for it or make communism seem as if it's oddly chic, in some way. And yet the people we're told to demonize, I'm quite sure Alex Jones has his problems, but it's some kind of, it's a psyop on the population that he's the demon. But these people who carried out atrocities on a scale the mind reels at, barely acknowledged. I mean, yeah, you do get me. Even John Lennon says something about Mao in a song, I mean, there's just some acknowledgement. But it's so often that you get, Stalin did help to industrialize Russia. Mao did bring China into the modern world. I mean, there's no but. there's no but for Alex Jones. You can say, well, on the other hand, he did do is nothing. And I say this as I'm not really in the Alex Jones orbit. I just raise him as an example of the kind of person who is enemy number one of the regime, but really whose crimes are, the needle doesn't even move when compared to people we should be concerned about. And yet, I wouldn't say not a word, but a very, very muted response to all this.
Yeah. And it really is astonishing how long a lot of the information about these episodes, how long it took to become more widely known. I mean, you may remember, Tom, I spent a year in China in the late 90s as a professor at a college there. And the students that I came into contact with, knew next to nothing about these episodes. They knew a little more about the Cultural Revolution. There were a lot more people who had, within living memory, who had been directly involved and who were survivors of it in various forms. So there had been some family history passed down for most people. But the Great Leap Forward was still a mystery to a lot of people. And the information was so tightly controlled in so many of these districts, even within China. It's a very large country. The information from one province to the next, wasn't flowing very well. And so it took a long, long time for some of these stories to start coming out and some of the calculations that had to be made to try to figure out just how many people suffered from these events. But I remember one of my acts of subversion to the Chinese communist regime when I was living there in China, I did make a trip down to Hong Kong at one point and came back with some books that had been released. This was in the late 1990s again. Some books that had recently been released, including Jasper Becker's book, Hungry Ghosts, which is one of the best treatments of the Great Leap Forward and goes into great detail about the kinds of suffering that had gone on. And I passed those books to my students who were completely shocked by the things they were reading and what had been kept from them, over the years. So we do now have, again, more information coming out about these incidents to the point where, as I said, even the Chinese Communist Party has been forced to moderate its praise of Mao to some extent. But this is easily the largest scale repression in human history that led to the death of up to 65 million people, depending on which estimates you're looking at. And this doesn't even include the Chinese Lao Gai, their concentration camp system, which was the largest penal system in human history, and which ruined the lives of an additional tens of millions of people who were sent there for imagined offenses and wound up either never being released and dying in the camps or losing their livelihood and all of their social status as a result. Because in Mao's China, once you're a suspect, you're always a suspect. There's never any room for the possibility of a mistaken accusation or anything like that. So We've got many tens of millions, maybe up to 100 million people whose lives were either ended or ruined by Mao's regime.
All right, before I go on, let me remind you about an app that's going to make your life way better, that's going to make you well-informed in a short period of time. Sounds kind of like the Tom Woods Show a little bit, doesn't it? But I'm talking about Blinkist, which takes all kinds of nonfiction categories of books and slims those books down for you to just 15 minutes of listening or reading. So you get all the key points, no fluff. I've told you about the old, old classics they have, like Machiavelli's The Prince and Seneca on Stoicism, but of course also a ton of modern books. For example, The Self-Driven Child, The Science and Sense of Giving Your Kids More Control Over Their Lives. That is perfect for our audience. And then you'll even find on Blinkist Murray Rothbard's book, For a New Liberty. And that's one of the early libertarian books I read that helped put things together for me, that helped me realize that in one area after another, there was a freedom-based answer to what ails us. It's the kind of thing that changes your life when you read it. And that's the kind of title you'll find many of at Blinkist. Well, right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/woods to start your free 7-day trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/woods to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/woods. I want to take a really, really quick tour of Eastern Europe here. I mean, there's so much more to your course, but people are just going to have to take it and listen to it while they're driving around. But Eastern Europe, I would like to just know a little bit more about, because I think we know more about the Soviet Union, what life was like there, than we do about what life would have been like in Romania day to day, or in any of these other countries day to day. Poland, for example, what was day to day life like? Was it less repressive in Eastern Europe than it was in the Soviet Union itself? What can we say about life in Eastern Europe? Can we draw broad conclusions, or were the individual cases very different from each other?
Well, I think if you want to generalize, I think you can generalize about Eastern Europe. It helps to think of it in essentially two phases during the communist era. And the first phase would be from the time that the Red Army moves into those countries in the latter stages of World War II. So we're talking about, again, Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria, Romania. They didn't get into Yugoslavia. Tito kept them out of Yugoslavia, and there was a rupture between Tito and Stalin, as you know. But all these other countries, they essentially have, even if there's some sort of lip service paid to democratic institutions or some kind of elections being held, within a few years of the end of the war, the communists have taken over all of these governments, with Soviet help. And from the late 1940s up until the death of Stalin, maybe a year or two after the death of Stalin, we have tremendous repression going on in those countries of Eastern Europe. And all the same kinds of things that were happening in the Soviet Union were happening in those countries. The Bolsheviks made it very clear that they were in the process of Sovietizing those countries. And so you've got horrific stories coming out of Bulgaria and Romania and all the rest, of camps being set up and the re-education, the horrible treatment of the church and seminarians, anyone suspected of harboring any kind of anti-communist sentiment or resistance. All of these people are under a huge amount of repression. After the death of Stalin, and we have the de-Stalinization campaign in the Soviet Union, which I don't really go into in the course because I'm focusing on the repressions themselves, but things do moderate. Even the Bolsheviks themselves seem to have recognized by that point that the things they're doing just aren't working. They're not bringing about the results they had hoped. So from the mid-50s up until the 80s, things aren't quite as crazy, but the repression never fully goes away. You've always got, the surveillance state, you've got the secret police and the informers everywhere. You have the censorship and all the various problems that go along with the central planning. All that kind of stuff is present in all of those countries of Eastern Europe. And you occasionally do have big crackdowns. And the most famous examples here are in East Germany in 1953, in Hungary in 1956, and in Czechoslovakia in 1968 with the so-called Prague Spring. And then in the 80s, in the early 80s, you did have martial law implemented in Poland in response to the activities of the labor union Solidarity, which was protesting various aspects of what was going on in Poland. So there's always some level of repression, but it's definitely less so than what you had in the late 40s and early 50s. But the estimates are that roughly 1 million people are killed in Eastern Europe during that period from the mid-40s up until 1989. So it's definitely, you know, not on the scale of what you saw in China or in the Soviet Union, but still a huge human toll.
What would you say of all the areas of the world that you studied would be the worst but yet least known atrocity or historical episode? And this is a very hard question to answer. It's like, what's your favorite movie in a way? You know, like, what's your, I have 8 million things to choose from. I can never answer those questions. What's my favorite song? I have no idea. So I don't know how hard I'm making this on you.
Yeah, I would probably point to two places when I think of like your average, you know, young adult American, what they know virtually nothing about. And that would be probably the Cambodia killing fields in the late 1970s, and then what happened in Afghanistan in the 1980s. So in Cambodia, the communists are only in charge for a little over 3 years, maybe 3.5 years. Yet they brought about the deaths of somewhere between 15 and 25% of the Cambodian population. So that was probably the one place where the communists said, we are not going to have any kind of transition from capitalism into a period of socialism into communism. They were dead set on putting, you know, getting everything in at once. And so they were doing these crazy things like they forcibly evacuated all the cities in Cambodia and they made everybody relocate to the countryside. They wound up in one region of the country in the eastern part of Cambodia, which borders Vietnam. They decided that the Vietnamese communists were undermining them and that the population of that region was assisting Vietnam too much. And so they basically said that entire district of Cambodia has the death penalty, you know, assessed on it. And so they went in and they killed a huge, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in that district. So in a very short period of time, we've got a population in 1975 in Cambodia of about 8 million people. And in 1979, somewhere between 6 and 7 million people still living in Cambodia. So that was probably the most drastic repression that we saw anywhere in the world. The other example I think that most people don't know about in America today is Afghanistan. And, you know, Tom, when you and I were growing up in the 1980s, we would occasionally hear things about what was going on in Afghanistan because the communists staged a coup there in 1978 and then tried to bring in a lot of very radical changes that prompted resistance among the population. And that led to a Soviet invasion of Afghanistan at the end of 1979. So throughout the 1980s, there's a Soviet presence in Afghanistan, a civil war going on there. And out of a population of about 15 million people in Afghanistan, about 10% of those people are killed during that decade. And, you know, up to about half of the population is forced from its homes. So we had millions of Afghan refugees pouring over into Pakistan and Iran, and some also coming to Europe and to the United States in the 1980s. Probably about 5 million people altogether. And then another 2 million people stayed within Afghanistan but lost their homes because of the military action. And so probably about half of the population of Afghanistan lost their homes. And then you've got huge numbers of stories of atrocities being perpetrated by both the Soviet Army and by the communist government in Afghanistan, which went on a radically secular agenda and tried to outlaw Islam, which was the religion of 99% of the Afghan population. They ran the entire Jewish community out of the capital city of Kabul. Those people all fled to Israel in the late 1970s and early 1980s. So those are two examples that I think most Americans have probably never heard of, but of extremely wide-scale repression and mass murder that we're still learning some of the facts about the scale of what went on there and the just the horrific experiences that people had in those places.
Well, it's hard to know how to end this because, of course, there are so many parts of the world we could talk about. You cover pretty much everywhere. You leave no stone unturned in telling these real stories and documenting what really happened. And as we both acknowledged, this is not information that people were just going to get naturally through the ordinary course of their educations. This is something you have to go out of your way to find. And you've helped to make it that much easier to find by means of your course. So the way to get this course on the crimes of communism is to go to libertyclassroom.com. We don't sell the courses a la carte. You get the whole membership. You get all the courses. And it's super duper inexpensive when you think about how much you're paying for even one community college credit hour compared to all the stuff we have. And in honor of Jason's course, if you use coupon code Jason, then you get a pretty big discount. I'm not going to say how big, but boy, you're going to have a big old grin on your face, ear to ear. All the different subscription plans, they're all going to be at a big discount, but just temporarily. Jason's a great guy and his course is wonderful, but all good things must come to an end. So head to libertyclassroom.com, use coupon code Jason. Well, Jason, thanks again for doing this. Now you can finally relax, and yet now the school year has started, now you can't relax.
Yeah, it's never a dull moment around here, Tom, but I've gotten used to it.
All right. Well, thanks again, Jason. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, everybody. We're not going to do any coupon codes. We're just going to do a flash sale at libertyclassroom.com. So head on over there, take advantage of that, and enjoy Jason's course and all the others that we got there for you. This is the history and economics they didn't teach you, as I like to put it. See you tomorrow, everybody.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.